Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Happy New Year! Later in the show, we welcome our regular guest hosts from the Ames Progressive Alliance, Victoria Shapinski and Ann Kinzel, together with their guest, Jody O'Donnell, who will discuss an event that drew hundreds of Ames residents to the library one evening a couple weeks ago to discuss how to ensure Ames remains a safe and welcoming place for minorities and disadvantaged groups among us. But first, we turn to the topic of education and President-elect's appointment of billionaire Betsy DeVos to head the Department of Education. Betsy DeVos has never taught in or attended public schools, yet it was her very wealthy family whose lobbying efforts led to the promotion and deregulation of charter schools in Michigan. I talk with a civil rights lawyer who has written about the consequences for Detroit schools. I then speak with Senator Herman Kernbach of Ames, a Democrat and ranking member of the Senate Education Committee, for whom federal policies are less a threat than the legislation that might emerge as a result of having Republican majorities in all three legislative houses. Peter Hammer is a professor of civil rights law at Wayne State University in Detroit and holds a Ph.D. in economics. In 2012, he published a paper in the Journal of Law and Society entitled The Fate of Detroit Public Schools. I spoke with him about what has happened to Detroit in the wake of policies promoted by billionaire Betsy DeVos, Trump's appointee as the nation's Secretary of Education.
You have to think about Detroit schools in the context of Michigan state finance rules for education as well as for charter schools. And you can't think about Michigan school finance or charter school policy without thinking about the DeVos family and their lobbying now for decades to make Michigan one of the most aggressive charter environments in the country. What that has done for the Detroit public schools in many ways has led to its demise, an unregulated charter school movement that enables the students to follow with the dollars really has led to the death knell of the traditional public school system.
In fact, Betsy DeVos wrote an op-ed in a newspaper there that it was time to retire the Detroit public schools and to, quote, liberate all students from them.
And it's a real bait and switch because it's the charter school policy that has led to the demise of the traditional public schools. And then, ironically, the same advocates for charter schools that led to the demise of traditional public schools stand on the sideline and advocate then that traditional schools fail and that you need more charter schools. It's incredibly insidious. Very little about what's happened to Detroit public schools is accidental. If you look at the state policy, it's a very simplistic formula where they have what they call a count day, and they count the number of kids in the school, and then the school gets X number of dollars for every child that's in the school seat. What that means is when you have a charter school open up next to a traditional public school and they enroll 1,000 students, they get all the money that used to go for the public school system. And that means then that the challenge that the Detroit public school has had and why it was under state emergency management control is they have the awful dilemma of trying to cut their costs faster than their revenues fall. And I know some of your listeners might need to hear that again. It's not that they have rising costs and that causes a deficit. They actually have their revenues falling faster than they can possibly cut their costs, and that's pretty much the problem for the schools.
Okay, because all of the kids have gone next door for that first day of school or whatever that count day is. And then if students are not satisfied with their experience at the school next door, do they return back to the public school?
The best analogy I've heard was from a real distressed parent of three Detroit school children. What she says what happens is parents get on a carousel now, and they'll go from one school to another school to another school with almost no continuity and no real rationale for the choices that they're making. So it's not even an experiment and then return to one system. There's so much confusion. It's like a kaleidoscope now. Where students and parents don't even know what a public school is and what a charter school is. There are very few metrics to let them have choice, and charter schools don't have to give any public transportation. So that becomes another strategic ploy that they can use to manipulate the type of parents and the type of students that they can attract.
Right, because we see some research, some studies that say that performance is better at charter schools, but that might be an association. Instead of cause and effect, it might be that students with more wherewithal are able to go to charter schools.
The best evidence that I've seen really says that you have some very good charter schools, just as you have some very good public schools, and you have some very bad charter schools, just as you have some very bad public schools. But by and large, there's not a substantial difference between charter and public schools. So you're not getting any kind of guaranteed increase in quality. And indeed, a number of the charter schools, especially in Detroit, because there is no quality control, and there is no rational process that says when you can open, when you can close the school, is that you've had a number of incredibly inexperienced charters open up and really engage in educational malpractice for the students that enter their doors.
Can you explain what you mean by no quality control?
Yeah, and again, people that aren't familiar with the Michigan system are just going to think it's crazy. There's more than a dozen separate entities that have the legal authorization to create a charter school or to authorize a charter school. Some of these are universities, some of these are community colleges, some of these are public school systems themselves. And it's just like, you know, doctors who cross state lines and their malpractice history doesn't follow them. There's no rhyme or reason. So there's not a single entity that says we'll open up schools if they're necessary. There's not a single entity that says we're going to close a school that if it's of poor quality. You have this hydra of more than a dozen authorizers competing against each other to see how fast they can open up charter schools and in places that they have no connection to. Very few of those authorizers, maybe two or three, have any direct connection to Detroit. And yet they're able to operate in Detroit without any experience or any real commitment to the city.
The DeVos family was very instrumental in eliminating a part of a bill that would have created that overseeing commission that would have been that single institution that could disqualify a school or a particular agency from expanding.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a really impressive coalition called the Coalition for the Future of Detroit School Children that had Democrats and Republicans. It had labor and management. It had business and nonprofits, an incredibly broad-based coalition. And their number one recommendation is you've got to move from the system where you have 13 authorizers, and you have to have one entity that's accountable to make these decisions about whether to open a school, whether to close it, and where to locate it. And that became one of the most important points in the legislative battle last summer. And it was the charter school lobby, largely funded by the DeVos family, that drove a stake into that proposal. And the single most important thing you could have done to try to make the Detroit school system better, they fought tooth and nail and they won. And this is a problem with the DeVos family, and it's a problem more largely with the charter school movement. It's all ideologically based. It's not empirically based. And so it's incredibly hard to make a reasoned, factual policy argument against people who don't listen to the evidence. So their policies that they're advocating have not learned from the catastrophe that they're creating. And my real fear is that same ideology is now going to affect national policy, and the entire nation could be subject to the same devastating policies that have really ruined the Detroit public school system. And so those that don't want that future really need to be arming themselves and preparing for a fight to maintain the quality and the form of education that they've had.
Are these schools, they're independent of the school district, but are they nonprofit? Are they for-profit? Are they a mixture of the two?
In theory, they're supposed to be nonprofits, right? So I create this nonprofit entity, but then that nonprofit can contract for a for-profit. And a majority of these of charter schools contract out to the larger dominant charter school players to actually administer the program. And sometimes you start following the money and saying, well, how much is going to the children? Many of these companies actually own the facilities where the school is run, and the percentage of the student allowance that actually goes to rent sometimes is astronomical. So it becomes a really sort of important game to follow the money all the way through the system and really track down how much school funding is actually going to educate children.
So it seems like the rhetoric is ideological, but there might be a practical component of the advocates' interest in charter schools as well.
Yeah, if you look at the just total dollars that the United States spends on education, it's huge. And if you think about education as a public good, you're saying we as a society are providing for the education of our children and providing for our future. If you're a for-profit company, you're saying, wow, what a huge revenue stream. And just as you see movements to privatize prisons, to me it's not much different than movement to charter schools. Most charter schools are ununionized, which means that, again, they make their profit by underpaying their teachers. And so the turnover rate, and again, I'm focusing on what's experienced in Michigan, in particular in Detroit, has been outrageously high. And so that notion that there's this continuity of education, that there's a student who knows that her older sister had the same teacher and forms that broader set of bonds, is almost impossible in the way that charters have evolved in Detroit and in Michigan. What it does is it fractures community. And at the end of the day, that whole model of traditional education as a public good that brings people together on a common set of values for a common cause has got to be the foundation in which we build quality education in cities like Detroit and elsewhere.
Are there any public schools remaining in Detroit?
Yeah, about 40% of the students in Detroit go to traditional public schools. But if you look at the numbers, it's like dropping off a cliff in terms of the revenue that supports traditional public schools, the number of schools, and the number of students enrolled in schools. And it really is a death spiral. And that's what I wrote 4 years ago, and it's been prophetic in the sense that everybody should know what's happening, and people should be held accountable for the charter school policies that they've advocated.
And that was Peter Hammer, professor of law at Wayne State University in Detroit. We're talking about Detroit because this is where incoming Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos made her mark, spending millions lobbying the Michigan legislature for an unregulated charter school system where students and their families, quote, vote with their feet for the kind of schools they'd like to attend. You're listening to Local Talk. Well, residents of Senate District 23 of Ames voted hands down to return Herman Kurmbach to office. Senator Kurmbach has served as the chair of the Education Committee in the Democrat-controlled Iowa Senate for the past 6 years. No longer, as a trifecta of Republican majorities in the governor's office, House, and Senate have taken control. I sat down with the senator to ask him about his concerns for the fate of public schools in Iowa in a situation lacking checks and balances. Herman, I just spoke with someone about Betsy DeVos and the change at the top of education on the federal level. So let's start with some policy issues, and then we'll get into the funding, which is what gets most of the attention during these legislative sessions. Betsy DeVos's big signature effort has been with charter schools. Charter schools are not that big a deal in Iowa, am I right?
That's correct. We initially authorized up to 10 charter schools in Iowa, but that was some years ago, and then the cap was lifted to 20, and then after that, in connection with the Race to the Top program from the Obama administration, we moved the cap entirely. Now, the actual fact was, though, we never got to the initial cap. There was at most 9 charter schools in the state. And according to the Department of Education in 2015, we were back down to 3. It's just not something that fits very well with Iowa. You can take a look at, for example, the Madrid School District. I used to represent Madrid when my district had part of Boone County. And they got a great school system down there, very strong support from the community. But they have one elementary school and one combined junior and senior high school. So how do you carve a charter out of that without collapsing the enrollment that they need to maintain an independent school system? Now, I think that to the extent that we see charters being pushed in Iowa, it represents a real threat to accelerating the process of school consolidation. It's a real threat to rural school districts.
There's a law in Iowa about who can form a chartered school. That might be up for grabs this session. I know that only a school district can form a charter school, whereas there are outside entities in other states that form charter schools.
I think that that's a very important point. You know, to the extent that a school district might want to experiment with an alternative form of a school, I think that that still needs to be overseen by the locally elected school board and not by some out-of-state or private entity. You know, Senator Harkin, when he was in charge of the Education Committee in the U.S. Senate, had a study done of the private for-profit colleges, and the results were very discouraging. A lot of fraud, a lot of abuse going on. I certainly don't want to repeat those mistakes with private for-profit charter schools.
And what is an issue, however, in Iowa is homeschooling. Homeschooling has, you know, works in a rural setting. Homeschooling is done across the state. And we've recently seen some amplification of the powers or liberties, you might say, of the homeschool movement. What has happened in homeschooling in Iowa, and what do you expect to be presented in this new upcoming session?
Well, we do have homeschooling in Iowa. It has existed for some years now. One form, the most common form, is called competent private instruction. There, parents can keep kids at home and school them at home. But there is some accountability in terms of annual testing requirements and other requirements, things along the line of having to file lesson plans and so forth. So I have no problem with that form of homeschooling. Basically got jammed down our throats back in 2013, this is with the education reform bill that created the teacher leadership program in the public schools. And I'm a big supporter of that idea. But what got jammed down our throats was a different form of homeschooling called independent private instruction, where there really is no accountability at all. Now, I don't have any problem at all, none at all, with parents who do homeschooling seriously, who put in the time and the effort, who work with their kids, and they can produce some pretty good results. I mean, think what a public school teacher could do with a class size that's that small and that level of parental involvement. It's not surprising to me that they produce good results, and I have every respect for them. But this independent private instruction, that opened the door to all kinds of abuse. I had heard, for example, from one school administrator, not in Ames, but from a nearby district, a kid had come in one day who looked like they'd been, you know, roughed up or beaten up. And, you know, school administrators are mandatory reporters, so they had to call the police. Well, the police contacted the family. The parent came in the next week, mad as hell, and pulled the kid out of the school, and now they're doing independent private instruction. So, you know, there's a potential for abuse there, and I think that we ought to tighten that up. I think there ought to be some oversight with homeschooling. Now, on the positive side, we have the Homeschool Assistance Program, which is a program where the school districts work with the homeschooling parents to provide them with some additional opportunities and support, and that's worked pretty well. In fact, the homeschool assistance program in Ames, there are people who will open enroll their kids into the Ames district, not to attend the Ames schools, but to participate in the Ames homeschool assistance program. And I'm requesting legislation be drafted that provides a slight increase in the funding for that program. I think it represents an accommodation between homeschool parents and school districts. School districts initially may have feared that, oh, well, homeschooling was going to, you know, drain all of their students. Well, not the case, because homeschooling isn't for everybody. It does involve a lot of parental sacrifice. And on the other side, parents were leery about the school system and what their requirements might be. I think both sides have found that there are things to be gained by trying to work together. And so I'm a supporter of the homeschool assistance program. But I think this independent private instruction, it went too far. I think we need to rein that in.
I asked Senator Kurmbach about the voucherization of homeschooling. In other words, the potential that the money that follows each child to the public school he or she attends might essentially get refunded to parents who homeschooled.
There have been proposals and legislation proposed by Republicans in the Iowa House in the last couple of years that would create what they call education savings accounts. It's really a misnomer. It's a voucher by another name. And that is something that I have some real problems with. You know, when you're basically not only allowing people to pull their kids out of the public schools, but paying them to do so, and then on top of that you have no accountability for their education, it's pretty easy to see how that could be abused. You know, not just the public money wasted, but the kids denied any kind of effective education.
Is there any chance that that might be presented again and have a favorable response this year?
Democrats are no longer in the majority. As committee chair of the Education Committee, something like that, had it reached my desk, probably would have filed it in a bad ideas file and left it for another time. But, you know, right now, things have changed. There may be things moving forward in the next couple of sessions that are very different and very radical. I am more than a little worried about that.
Can you talk about some of those other bills that you that every year you might have filed in the circular file, but that may gain some traction this year? Are we worried about cuts to the preschool program, for instance? Is that something that we should be concerned about?
That's one of the concerns that I have. You know, we instituted the program back in 2007. And I think it's been really quite successful. We've got Head Start program in the state. We have an older program called Shared Visions. When I last looked at these numbers about 2 years ago, those three programs combined, we were reaching, give or take, about 70% of the four-year-olds in the state. But when the Republicans took over the House and Governor Branstad succeeded Governor Culver back in 2011, the House Republicans tried to kill the program entirely. The governor wanted to voucherize it, to limit it only to low-income students. And we Democrats, we said no. Every kid, I mean, the research shows clearly, every kid benefits from preschool program. Those from less fortunate backgrounds gain at least as much, if not more. So it helps reduce the gap, but everybody benefits. And so, yes, I am worried that you may see proposals again to cut back on the preschool program. I think that would be a tragic mistake. My front and center concern is education funding. I expect to see proposals for significant tax cuts in Iowa, and that's going to very directly and negatively impact education. About 60%, very roughly, 60% of the state budget goes to fund education at all levels, including the universities. So every $100 million that's cut, that means a $60 million cut in education. Now, over the last 5 years, our main funding vehicle, our main funding stream to local school districts, referred to usually as allowable growth, adjusted for inflation over 5 years, cumulatively 0.1%. At a time when we're trying to put computers in the hands of every student, at a time we're trying to expand science labs and science and math education, you know, STEM education, and we're trying to overall upgrade our curricula to have no increase in funding, I think we're setting standards for school districts that they don't have the resources to meet. So, you know, we're facing right now $100 million revenue shortfall. The revenue isn't quite coming in. So that's the current fiscal year that we're going to have to adjust for that. And then the following fiscal year, if they're going to cut taxes and cut revenues even further, I just see that as setting up a crisis situation for education funding.
Anything else that you're concerned about in terms of this upcoming legislative session?
Well, yeah, there are a couple of things. You know, I think that we need to update our anti-bullying statute. The Governor Branstad, made that one of his priorities a couple years ago, and the Senate did pass a good, strong anti-bullying bill. The House refused to take it up. You know, now that Republicans are in control of both houses, I don't think that it's likely. In fact, if anything, I think that protections for LGBT students and especially for transgender students may actually be rolled back. I'm very unhappy about that. And the other thing that I worry about is collective bargaining. You know, we've had 40 years of labor peace in the public sector in this state because of a collective bargaining law that was signed into law by Republican Governor Bob Rae. We've had no teacher strikes, no blue flu, no firefighter walkouts, no interruptions of public service at all. Because we have a law there that provides for a procedure for arbitration to settle these disputes in an appropriate legal format. If you start weakening the collective bargaining law, then you're opening the door to the possibility of teacher strikes or other interruptions of public service. I think that also would be a mistake. If you look at how the system has worked, you know, teacher pay in Iowa is about 25th in the country. So we're competitive, but not excessive by any means. I think the system has worked pretty darn well. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
On the topic of disputes, I wanted to get Senator Kernbach's response to an allegation made by Representative Rob Bacon, representing Gilbert and Slater. This past fall, I was privileged to moderate a League of Women Voters debate between Bacon and his Democratic challenger, Sherry Teha, where I asked this question about the timing of education funding legislation. And you also, Representative Bacon, mentioned that budgeting education should come first. For 2 years running at least, maybe more, lawmakers in the House have disregarded the rules or law that stating that the education budget for the subsequent school year, as well as the upcoming school year, be set. Now, assuming that lawmakers should not, on a routine basis, break the law, do you think the rule needs to be changed, or should lawmakers adhere to it?
May I go first on that one?
Yes.
Okay. First, I have just a little issue with the question, the way you asked it. Okay, it's not only the House. If you were to read all the press release, it always sounds as though it's the House that's the issue with that. We've sent bills over, and they have sat on the desk of the powers that be in the Senate, and they've never taken them up. Or they haven't come to the meetings when the meetings were scheduled. The House Republicans will present a bill and send it over, and it will sit there. We just basically need to reach across the aisle and work side by side. Can I just say that?
Your response, Senator Kernbach.
I don't know what Representative Bacon is thinking. That he's just flat wrong on the facts. And whether he's just ignorant or whether he's deliberately mendacious, I can't say. I can tell you that for each of the last 6 years, the Senate has passed the allowable growth bill on time within the first 30 days of the session. In each of the last 6 years, the House has failed to produce a bill at all or failed to produce one timely. I know that because it's the responsibility of the Education Committee to start those bills, and I've chaired that committee. We have met our deadline in producing a bill from the committee, and the bill has passed the Senate floor on time each of the last 6 years. We're 6-for-6, and the House is 0-for-6.
Anything else you'd like to say about this upcoming session, and in particular the education legislation that that you will have your hands on in some way, shape, or form?
Well, I'd just like to say that, you know, there are a number of things where we have found common ground in recent years. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about potential areas of conflict, but we have found common ground. The education bill in 2012 that emphasized early grade reading, the education reform bill in 2013 that created the teacher leadership program, the education bill this last session for career and technical education that is really going to revamp what I guess we used to call vocational ed, set up regional partnerships with the community colleges and the high schools and the business community to identify skill shortage areas and develop training programs for kids to start on in the high school and follow on in community college so that we can get them in the pipeline to get the high-paying jobs, to fill the labor needs that businesses have. Everybody wins. We had great bipartisan work together on that. So, you know, to the extent that constructive, middle-of-the-road proposals can come forward where we can find common ground, I'm absolutely committed to working together cooperatively to get that done. When people, though, want to try to undermine or attack or to unfund, defund the public schools, well, you're going to find me speaking out quite strongly on the other side.
Thank you so much, Herman Kernbach.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. We've been joined in the studio by members of the Ames Progressive Alliance, who have a monthly segment here on Local Talk, the fourth and sometimes fifth Friday of the month. So, Victoria Shapinski and Kenzel, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. On November 29th, the Ames Progressive Alliance sponsored Inclusive Ames, A Time to Act, at the Ames Public Library. The Ames Human Relations Commission and the Ames Public Library were partners with the APA for this event. The event focused on bringing people together in small group discussions, and the goal was to foster a sense of community, inclusiveness around progressive goals after a very polarizing national election. Our guest today, Jody O'Donnell, is a member of the APA Steering Committee who played a big role at the Inclusive Ames event. An event which took a lot of work by a lot of people, but from my vantage would not have gone off so well without the hard work of my co-host, Victoria Shapinski, who I think is a former, event? Manager, planner, guru?
Yeah, we like to keep that a secret.
Okay. Well, Jody, welcome. We're glad to have you here to share your thoughts on Inclusive Ames and where that event is taking us as we move forward towards a more progressive Ames community. But before we get into that, can you tell us a little bit about what drew you to membership in the Ames Progressive Alliance?
Well, I think it began when you all had one of your first events, the big picnic, and we were all asked to weigh in on those issues that were going to be important to us. I truly felt that was one of the beginning ways of people to build the community, to get an idea of what everyone felt about was going to be a progressive community, because to my mind, it's about the coming up from the bottom. That's mm-hmm. how progressive action is always taken place, truly progressive action. So I liked that. I liked that it was going to be I hesitate to use the word grassroots because I think that's misused. I think it was just that it was organic, and it was so I think the next step is Ames Progressive Alliance is going to be bringing that together, taking a look at how we organize those efforts.
Has it been fun?
Yeah, it's been a learning experience, and I think what people, what I would think is good to remember is that it's not going to be straight line. It's going to be a little bit messy, but we all got to hang in there.
Yeah. And we've had some great successes. We've done quite a few events over the time, and we've been here to talk about them. But I just want to say a little bit more about our Inclusive Ames event, I think, which was very indicative of how we are a growing organization, and that our timing is now, given what is happening nationally, and that at the Inclusive Ames event, we drew 300 people to the library on that November evening. We had so many people that we overflowed into the Elks Club across the street, which we've now learned is a handy opportunity. We knew that from the national media and social media and other sources that many people were looking for opportunities to get involved and to take some action, and that's what we're all about. We may not at this moment in time be able to influence the national government, but the opportunity to speak up and take action and create impactful change and resistance will be happening across the country at a local level. So as I said, our time is now. I'll give a little background on what we did at that event, and that is that we invited several local and state issue-based organizations to join us and asked that they submit questions that addressed major concerns or threats that their particular organizations and members felt that were paramount. We had representatives join us from the ACLU of Iowa, One Iowa, Access, Primary Health Care here in Ames, the NAACP local chapter, League of Women Voters, Planned Parenthood, the Emergency Residence Project, YSS. Greta was there, and Ursula from KHOI.
It was a great event.
Thank you. And we were pleased that you were there, and hopefully we found some volunteers to join on to KHOI. But we were challenged with bringing a variety of concerns together and creating sort of condensing them into three questions so we'd have something manageable for small groups to talk about. And the three questions that were derived out of the many too many, I would say, concerns was the first one is we asked how do we address threats and advocate for the unique needs of refugees, LGBTQ individuals, people of color, targeted faiths, and immigrants. The second question was how can the Ames community empower and equip families and all young residents to help combat discrimination in all of its forms that has been amplified since the election. And the third was how can we get more people involved in local progressive leadership? We asked participants to break into these small groups and specifically to sit with people that they did not know. And from each of the three questions, the groups were asked to suggest actionable steps. Next, we asked the participants to join an action team connected to each question or to join an Ames Progressive Alliance Standing Committee. So maybe I'll just turn to Jody here a bit, as you were the conversation starter that evening, and have you take it up from there, and we can talk a little bit more about what the next steps are.
I think we wanted to make it meaningful for people to be there, and obviously they were brought there by some passions and concerns and fears, etc. So wanted to start very early with helping them to understand what this event was about in terms of connecting those passions with local government and civic engagement. I think a lot of us pay attention to what we need to do in our personal and our professional lives, but not particularly our civic lives. And I think that we thought that it was, to my mind, it was an opportunity to begin to help people to learn a little bit about what that involved. One of the things that I think was an important message that we conveyed at the very beginning is that when we look at what's happening nationally and even statewide, that we're going to be looking to our local governments, our city governments, to really enact some change. This is where we have, as citizens of Ames and a community, to make some differences. And one of the ways that we were doing that that evening was to look at how we could reduce divisive acts, to set a certain standard of how we act within Ames, how we are inclusive and what that means, which is what we had the ability as citizens of Ames to be able to do. And I know that we wanted to convey to people that in the discussions we're going to have, we're going to be the beginning of how we were going to help build the connections and the capabilities and the capacity that would enable us to work towards some of these common goals. This is where we have the power. This is where we can make our community better and change it, change the world locally.
And one of my mantras has been, and people have heard me say this before, is that I don't believe that many of us realize what a impact local government has on our daily lives. And I didn't realize it myself until I had the opportunity to be a member of the Ames City Council and realize the highly impactful decisions that we were making on how dollars were spent on human services, for example, and then all those things that we take for granted. I mean, our power, our water, but you can shape through local government how your community is connected to the rest of the nation and whether you participate in large initiatives. Those things can all be done at a local level. This whole thing recently of declarations that are being made in New York and San Francisco and Seattle about being resistant to initiatives that are excluding particular groups of people. Cities are standing up and saying, we're not going to be a part of that, and we don't even care if we lose some of our federal dollars. This is more important to us. And these are the types of things that we can do as a community if we participate at the very minimum by voting, but by working on campaigns, by running for office.
Well, historically, the turnout rate at local races is much less in Ames than national or state races. That leads me to think that a very small number of people could actually make a very big difference in Ames by exercising their right to vote here in our community. It just doesn't take but probably a few hundred or maybe 1,000 people more to vote to change Ames into a very progressive community. I think the event can show us that. If we can get 300 people out on a November night, I think that we can get more people to participate in an election. So, Jody, you had the opportunity, I saw you, to circle around and kind of listen to people in their discussion groups. Tell me a little bit about what you observed.
Well, it was funny. I think one of the first things we did was ask people to talk about what had brought them there. And the stories poured out of people. You could just hear what they were most concerned about. An amazing sort of connect, you know, beginning to connect. I think that one of the things that Matthew Goodman said in wrapping up was that you didn't sit at home. You came and you connected with your fellow and sister citizens here, and having that connection was, I think, so important to people. So that was one of the things. But the discussions, it was funny to me to see how that people came with such a great intentionality to really bring their best selves to this, to really, really engage in that evening. And I thought that was such a good sign for Ames. I really do. I think that is to have that sort of energy, that people are bringing their best selves to that. I want to see that continue. I think that it is so important to make sure that people feel that the journey is going to be long. It's going to be one where we're all learning as we go away. But as long as our intentionality about what we want to achieve is foremost, then I think that we're going to be able to make the progress that we want to.
I think Jody makes an excellent point. At all our events, I think people do show up with intentionality. From our first picnic in Brookside Park, when we had over 350 people, yeah. That enthusiasm, that intentionality has continued. So that's important. Speaking of that, the November event is just a start for the APA. So I'd like Jody and Victoria to tell us a little bit more about what's next on the APA agenda. There were lots of post-it notes put up at that meeting suggesting directions. So how about telling us a little bit about what's next?
Well, I can speak to that a little bit. And the post-it notes, we broke people into small groups, which we have done at other events that we have hosted, and we find that that is really a good model for getting people to be able to think about actions. Because it's one thing to talk, we're all able to do that, but we really need to be thinking collectively about what we can do. And even if they're small victories, we can start there. So we asked groups to write on post-it notes actionable items. And so we put those all together. We kind of took them all and grouped them a bit, and we found some commonality. And we will now be meeting in these groups of the questions. People signed up if they wanted to meet and further move on the three questions that I read earlier. And so we will be gathering in January. All the meetings will be at the library, which has turned out to be a wonderful venue for a lot of reasons. On Saturday, January 14th, question one, we will be addressing.
Tell us what question one is again.
Okay, question one was, how do we address threats and advocate for the unique needs of refugees, LGBTQ individuals, people of color, targeted faiths, and immigrants? And I would add women, because yes. I think we're a group that has been targeted. And so that question will be further discussed, and looking for actual actions that we can agree on Saturday, January 14th from 1 and to three. And as I said, that will be at the library. Question two was, how can the Ames community empower and equip families and all young residents, because we tend to forget children sometimes, to help combat discrimination in all its forms that has been amplified since the election? And that group will be meeting on Wednesday, January 18th, from 6:30 to 8:30. And the third question, how can we get more people involved in local progressive leadership, will be on Monday, January 23rd from 6:30 to 8:30. And in reviewing all of those, I mean, a lot of what I saw was people want, one of the actions is people want more education. For example, on the progressive leadership, and maybe I already said that, about learning how to be involved in elections, how to run for something. But when we get to these meetings, the members of the Ames Progressive Alliance who will be there we've already sent out to people who gave us their email addresses, all the post-it notes, and we've combined them in some ways, but we don't see it as our role to be determining what those actions will be. It will be the group deciding how we are going to move forward.
So Ames Progressive Alliance folks would be there to help facilitate
exactly.
these action teams as they develop how to take the next steps.
Yeah. Yep. And maybe we'll be meeting some more. I mean, all that will flow out of our next meetings.
Well, those sound like important questions and ones that our community, I think, will be excited to take on.
Yeah. And it was a challenge. I mean, we struggled over these questions because there were so many different concerns, and to try and make them manageable and congeal it into three questions, mm-hmm. they turned out a little bit broad, but at the same time, they seemed to work when people were mm-hmm. having their group discussions.
So if you were putting yourselves in the shoes of a new attendee at one of these events, what would you be looking to do or say or participate? How do you see that going?
Well, I think it's just, be there to, again, that we're looking to, that it's a learning process. I think that people think that they can't get involved because they just don't know. And I think that I would be the first to say, I don't know a lot. and I think that you come to learn, you come to express. I think that to remember that it's a process, that there are many, many steps that we're going to be taking along the way. I think it's important to stay engaged. So even if the experience in, let's say that you come to one of these meetings, isn't what you had thought it was going to be, or doesn't produce maybe what you are in your gut feeling like you want to have happen, still stay engaged. I think that we're all trying here to do what is best. If we start to opt out because it hasn't been everything that we wanted it to be, then that's where we're not going to be able to make any progress. And I think that that's been a problem in the past, not only locally, but at a state and national level. It's like, I can't do anything about this, so I'm not going to. I'm here to say that we do have that. It's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be straight line, but stay engaged. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, different people came for different reasons. I mean, some people just needed to have an opportunity to connect, to know that they're not isolated in their concerns about what is going on. And others came looking for action. I also want to add that if you were not able to attend the November meeting, that in no way excludes from joining us in future meetings. We want people to add on to what's going on and connecting to the Ames Progressive Alliance at every turn. We have a website, which is Ames Progressive Alliance, what is it, .org?
.org.
We have a Facebook page, Ames Progressive Alliance. We have a Gmail address that you can send us your name if you'd like to be added to the email list. I always guarantee people we're a volunteer organization, so you will not be inundated with emails. We send them out as needed, and that's Ames Progressive Alliance at gmail.com.
Well, if I heard a thread in what the two of you said about participating in this, is that don't let perfection be the enemy of the good in building community. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we do a lot of things at the Ames Progressive Alliance. One of the things we've done in the past is progressive pints.
Yes.
where we meet at the Torrent Brewery and discuss a issue. And people can just come together, hold conversations, very informal, drink an adult beverage or a non-adult beverage. We will be resuming that, I think, in February. And be sure to check on our Facebook page for that date. We always keep that pretty well updated, even as a volunteer
organization. We do, and we keep, you know, if we see interesting articles, we try to post them on there. And, you know, we ask people to check it out as frequently. And the thing with Progressive Pints, and I think also a lot of the events that we do, it's about action, but it's also about meeting other people in our community. We did an event not so long ago at the Body of Christ Church where, for many of us, what was important beside the issue of bringing our police department and others together and thinking how we're going to move forward and make sure that we're a safe community for everyone was just meeting people. I mean, there was a whole group of people there that I don't mind admitting I'd never met before. And that's what leads to a more inclusive, safer community is we don't have to hang out. But if I recognize you on the street, it's a huge leap forward.
And it's not just always about politics. There was a recent article in the New York Times about how one of the leading determinants of good health is your social connectedness. Mm-hmm. If you are isolated, your health is going to be poor. So this is really speaking beyond politics and talking about building a community where people support each other, where they know each other and care about each other's lives. And this goes so far beyond politics, but it is a progressive goal to have connected communities.
Well, that's a great note to end on, because here at KHOI, we try to build community through communication and connect with all kinds of people. Thank you so much, Victoria Shapinski and Ann Kinzel. You have a final note, Ann.
Yes, I'd like to thank Jody O'Donnell for coming so early in the morning and participating in this. And as always, we'd like to thank KHOI for hosting this show and helping us build a more progressive community. And remember, December 31st is right around the corner. If you feel like acting locally, support KHOI with your local tax deductible contributions.
All right. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Our topic for the first half of the hour was the potential changes in education policy with the influx of Republican legislators on the federal and state level. We talked to Peter Hammer, professor of civil rights law at Wayne State University in Detroit, about what happened in Detroit when charter school entities were given free rein with little to no oversight or regulation. This is relevant to us nationwide as the key promoter of these policies, Betsy DeVos, will, if confirmed, be the next Secretary of Education. I also spoke with Iowa Senator Herman Kurmbach about the situation of education policy and funding in Iowa now that the Education Committee he chaired for 6 years is under Republican control. Ames Progressive Alliance joined us for the second half of the hour to discuss how Ames can be more inclusive. Their guest was Jody O'Donnell. And they mentioned three events coming up in January, January 14th, a Saturday, January 18th, a Wednesday, and January 23rd, a Monday, all at the library to continue their work of inclusive Ames. You can link to their Facebook page from our homepage, khoifm.org, and find out more about that. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by myself, Greta Anderson. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team of reporters, you can contact us through our website or call us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Many thanks to you all for helping us reach and exceed our funding goal of $25,000 in our recent pledge drive. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.